Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org, or download our iPhone and Android app for program and schedule information and podcasts of past programs. I'm Frank Meerkamp, Managing Director with Accenture, and I'm also a member of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors and your chair for this program. Tonight's program is underwritten by Accenture, and we are a global management consulting and technology services company. You would have to be on another planet not to know the phenomenon that has become Twitter, with over 500 million registered users, generating over 340 million tweets and over 1.6 billion search queries per day. Twitter has transformed the face of social media and political activism. Tonight we are pleased to have as our special guest the CEO of Twitter, Dick Costolo. Mr. Costolo will be in conversation with New York Times columnist Nick Bilton, who knows him well and will introduce him to you. Mr. Bilton is a technology and business columnist for the New York Times, as well as the lead blogger for the Times Bits blog. His background spans design, journalism, hardware hacking, data visualization, and time spent in the film and advertising industries. So please welcome Dick Costolo in conversation with Nick Bilton.
Do we have a ping pong ball? We can yes. Play that. What is that game called?
Whoever drinks the water first gets the wine. So that's what we'll do.
I'm just going to introduce Dick Costolo. He's the bold man to my right. So the last bold person I interviewed here was the 4-hour chef. We did this on the same stage.
He's bald by choice.
By choice, yes. Did I just bring something up? I shouldn't have.
Those are hurtful words.
Dick is currently the CEO of Twitter, as we all know, formerly the COO. Prior to working at Twitter, he helped co-found 3 startups. Is that correct?
That's correct.
I read your Wikipedia page. I really have no idea what I'm doing.
That's not all, actually. My Wikipedia page, someone keeps putting on it that I have a master's in computer science from Berkeley. I never went to Berkeley, and they keep deleting it, and someone keeps re-adding it. So I'm worried that years from now, people are going to say, he lied on his Wikipedia page. But anyway, I didn't go to Berkeley.
One of the websites that Dick co-founded was sold to Google for, I believe, $1 billion. That's right. Your Wikipedia page. And he was also formerly an improv comic in Chicago. So I have a question. Why are you – you were an angel investor in Twitter. Why are you Dick C? Why not at Dick?
It was already taken.
What?
Yes, it was already taken. So, the service was started in 2006. I was an angel investor in it. I didn't create my ID until the South by Southwest was in 2007 when it kind of took off.
So you invested even though you didn't actually sign up?
At Dick was
I have a company I want to talk to you
up.
About.
Yeah. Yeah.
So can you tell us a little bit about what your day-to-day is as CEO of Twitter? Do you just spend all day tweeting and faving, funny tweets?
Yeah.
What do you do?
So I spend a great deal of my time now on the organization, both structurally, and I'll describe what I mean by that a little bit, and then culturally. So one of the things that I observed was, if you'd talked to me about core values, for example, 4 years ago, I would have given you some Dilbert answer and rolled my eyes and said, people just need to get back to work. But one of the things I recognized as we were trying to start to scale the company and grow internationally and open other offices was that there wasn't a shared understanding of what it meant to work at Twitter. And in fact, I observed this a little bit early on where people would describe something as Twittery and this, to be fair, is not unique to Twitter. I mean, people who've worked at Google will recognize this as well. People will say, "Oh, that's very googly." And I didn't know what it meant other than this is really cool. We should have one of these. You know, this feels really Twittery. And so I wanted to codify what it meant to be at Twitter and work at Twitter. So we set about, with this female engineer who was one of the first engineers in the company and one of the first employees at the company, came up to me and talked to me about the notion of codifying our core values while I was thinking about this. And she said, you know, the research actually says that companies who have codified these things, where there's a real shared belief and understanding about what they are, they're not just, you know, written down on postcards and no one ever talks about them again. They actually correspond with financial results. And so we set about doing that, and when we went to define them, we said there are two things about them that we want to be true. One is we want them to help inform decisions. So they weren't going to be abstractions like honesty, integrity, and so forth. In fact, if you go back and look at Enron's core values, they were things like honesty, integrity, and anyway, whose core value is not integrity, right? Like, it almost makes it seem like, by default, of course, we wouldn't have integrity, but now we're going to codify that as a core value. So we wanted them to be things that could help us make decisions [S2] Yeah. [S1] And be concrete things, not abstractions. And then secondly, we wanted them to be things that were already true about the company, not, wouldn't it be great if we all believed that? Of course, none of us believe that now. So they ended up being, you know, one of them, just as an example, and then we can move on, is...
I think we're done with the interview already, so thank you.
is grow our business in a way that makes us proud.
Yes.
And the reason that is it evolved toward that incarnation was one of the things we felt about things like... Don't be evil. I'll keep on referring to Google since I worked there for a couple of years and pulled many of the things I liked about Google over to Twitter. One of the things we felt was a little bit awkward about that was you could do a lot of things and then say, well, it's not really evil. I mean, we didn't kill anybody, and then justify that. But that grow our business in a way that makes us proud had a you know, you could look at that and say, is this something we want to get up and really tell people about, or are we going to try to,
yeah,
you know, hide that or not announce it? And it's helped us make decisions. Like during the Super Bowl a couple of years ago, we had an offer to do something on our homepage and turn the bird into a particular logo that I won't describe now and change it for the day. And we just decided, look, is that something we're going to be like, hey, you know, kids, guess what daddy did today, you know, and or stand up in front of the company and say, you guys aren't going to believe this, but, you know, in our mission to change the world, we're changing the bird into, you know, this particular icon. And so we decided not to do that because it wasn't something we thought we would be proud of.
So instead you decided to put a giant helmet on the bird? we'll dress it. when you first started at the company, there were, I believe, 90 employees. Is that correct?
No, it was less than that. It was about 50.
About 50.
Yeah.
And now there are 1,600.
Yes.
And what do all those people do?
Well, we have to read all the tweets.
They go and they read all the tweets and they fave them.
Yes, yeah. That's right. They're the ones that read all the tweets and fave them.
Yeah.
Over half of them are engineers.
So
we have over 50% engineering, and that's a metric that we watch very carefully and stick to. One of the things that I hold dear is that we always want Twitter to feel like a technology company, and I believe that as long as we've got, you know, half or more than half of the company are engineers, it will by default be an engineering-driven company. And so we stick to that metric very closely. And then there are a bunch of other metrics within that. You know, the answer to what do 800 engineers do when, you know, it's only 140 characters, it turns out that with the volume of tweets that get sent out across hundreds of millions of people, some of whom have tens of millions of followers, feathering those tweets in as they pour in real time, not here's what happened a minute ago, but in real time as it happens, is an extraordinary technology challenge in multiple dimensions, and keeping ahead of that is an incredible challenge.
Well, so it's interesting you bring that up. So is that challenge different than Facebook's challenge as far as an engineering challenge? Because you guys suffered from some, you know, some issues with the site being down early on. Facebook did not. Is it because of just the way the site was built in the beginning, or is it because there is a different challenge with saying, hey, I'm Lady Gaga, I have 38 million followers, and when I tweet, my tweet has to go to all of them, versus I am Lady Gaga, I have 5,000 friends?
Well, I think it's two different things.
Okay.
So I think it's two different questions. So one, I think there are probably some architectural similarities in the kinds of service-based architectures that both companies need to build in order to more efficiently create new code. And those architectures are probably generally about around scaling and extensibility of doing lots and lots of different things on the platform. How you require less servers to do more kinds of things. That sort of thing is probably a similar architectural challenge at Google, at Facebook, at Twitter, et cetera. Having said that, it's also the case that the Twitter architecture in the beginning was built on a very monolithic structure. In fact, it was built in Ruby on Rails, and we refer to the old Rails architecture as the monorail because it's monolithic Rails infrastructure, and we've spent a great deal of time porting that brittle infrastructure to a more distributed, efficient, modern architecture.
Got it. Okay. Twitter prides itself on being a company that that does good in the world and that makes good decisions as far as a corporation. And, you know, you can look at WikiLeaks, there's 100 things that we've all read in the newspaper about it. Do you really believe that a corporation can be good?
Well, I don't know what's the converse? Does it mean a corporation's bad? Let me answer it this way. Uh-huh. Let me see if this answers your question.
Okay.
I don't believe that, the pursuit of doing the right thing for your users and trying to affect beneficial change in the world is at loggerheads with being a profitable enterprise. So that's, I guess, how I think about it. You know, that's how I think about it.
Have there been any instances where you look back at decisions you've made at Twitter or Twitter's made itself where they have crossed that line of doing good or any of those moral core values that you put together because it's better for the business or no? Is there always strictly a moral fence that stands there?
Oh, you can, you know, in philosophy classes, you can have ethical debates about various issues on and on and on. And there are lots and lots of things that straddle a line and you have to make a decision about even ignoring the business or commercial component, was this the right, purely in the context of, you know, it was the right thing for our users, but was it the right thing for the world? Or conversely, it's the right thing for the world, but is it the right thing for our users? We struggle with those things all the time, yeah. Absent whether they have anything to do with the business. You know, it may be, you can throw any number of examples out. So we struggle with those decisions all the time when we have to make them. And I don't think that it's been the case that I can think of that we've ever had to make a choice between the right commercial decision and the right ethical decision. Yeah. It's usually a choice between what's the right ethical decision here because this group benefits and this individual doesn't, or vice versa.
Okay. Speaking of ethics and all those wonderful things, I believe that Twitter is a company that stands apart from others in the Valley that have blue logos in their social networks because you do make decisions that I believe are in the goal of bettering society, but you have this thing called the verified user,
yes.
Right? Which I think goes completely against every moral core of what Twitter is. Why do you have it, and why not make everyone make it available so everyone can be verified, or get rid of it? Because it is a point of contention. It comes up quite a lot with people.
Sure. The reason we have verified users, so for those of you who don't have the context of what Mr. Bilton is asking about, noted hardware hacker.
That's right.
there are certain folks on the platform. You can sign up with any sort of, you don't have to sign up with your actual name. When I came to Twitter, I didn't have to sign up as Richard W. Costolo, the way I do on a Facebook or Google+, I can sign up with at Dixie. I could also, if it was available at the time, have signed up with at the president. So, you know, you can search for Barack Obama and maybe find six people. So we, of course, want to be able to let people know who the actual Barack Obama, President of the United States, account is. So we verify accounts in which there is confusion about whether this is the real account or a parody account, for example. Right? We allow parody accounts and so forth. And so we'll verify users in cases where there is some worry or concern about, is this the real band? Is that actually the president? Et cetera, et cetera. It's also the case that because we've just got this naming convention where, you know, Victor Wagner can sign up with at VW, right, at Volkswagen, has to be at Volkswagen. And so we do verification to sort of signify, hey, this is the account that you are, might be looking for in this instance. All right, that's a long explanation. So, of course, contention comes up when some people want to be verified and they don't meet the verification criteria. Like,
what is the verification
criteria? Well, there are a number of them, and they include things like there's no confusion about, you know, who you are, or there's not four other people who have fake accounts for you out there, and on and on and on. There are certain kinds of organizations like bands, musical bands, that we have verification criteria around that we don't have for commercial organizations just because of the way the platform evolved. So I think it's fair to say that as the platform continues to evolve, this is something that we'll continue to look at. It's absolutely been something that we've continued to think about, how verification and the notion of verification evolves over time. And we just have to, it'll be something we continue to look at.
Got it. What are you guys doing with search? You've released a bunch of new search features and search products lately. Are you going after Google? Are you going after Facebook? Are you just trying to make search a fun thing for people to do on Sunday afternoons?
I think that we think real-time search is really important. And, you know, if I'm at the San Francisco 49ers game when Alex Smith, or I'm watching it on TV, and I come in after Alex Smith gets injured, and I type in, you know, what happened to Alex Smith into a traditional search engine, I get, well, he was drafted in the second round out of, you know, and what you want is... He graduated from, Berkeley. He was a bachelor's in computer science, like his friend Dick Costolo. What you want is, you know, well, he pulled his hamstring or whatever it is. So we want to be the place that people think, I need to know the answer to what just happened in this case, and where people go to answer that question.
So there's an instance, a couple months ago I was down on the Embarcadero and I saw smoke billowing out of a building and I was like, I didn't go to any news organization. I went to Twitter and I typed in smoke. And it just so happened, like, smoke San Francisco, I found it. And it was like people that were tweeting about it. So will I be able to go to a point and be like, holy shit, there's smoke billowing out of a building. What's going on? And Twitter will be able to answer me that question?
I hope so. Listen, it's already the case, I think, that when events are happening in the real world, global events or events specifically relevant to me right now, like the fire, or global events like the World Cup, people turn to Twitter or tune into Twitter to see what's going on and contribute to the conversation of what's going on right now. It's absolutely critical that, given that's the case, that search has to be a driver for people to dive into that conversation and understanding and context immediately. And I think we're doing a better and better job of that. You just sort of, pointed to the notion that becomes a important piece of that context. That's also relevant to, what's happening right now based on where I am.
I have all these cards. Can you just pick one? We'll just do it that way. do you think Nick Bilton is awesome? Well, that's a good question. I'm just kidding. I'm totally just messing around. Are you still teaching the management classes at Twitter? So Dick teaches a management class where he actually goes in and does a six-hour course with all of the Twitter managers, teaching them how to be a good manager both in real life and offline. Are you still teaching that course with 1,600 employees?
I am. And when I mentioned earlier that one of the things I'm primarily focused on right now is the organization, both structurally and culturally, that's a huge part of it. So the Managing at Twitter course started because, almost innocuously, I had an engineer come up to me and say, who had transferred between teams. They were on one particular engineering team, and they transferred to another engineering team within the company. And they came up to me one day and said, hey, the manager I worked for over on revenue engineering had one-on-ones with me every week. And the manager I'm working for now on whatever happened to be infrastructure engineering, you know, doesn't believe in one-on-ones. So which is it? What are they supposed to be doing? What are managers supposed to be doing here at Twitter? And then it was one of those funny things where, you know, it wasn't something I thought about all the time. And then once I saw this individual instance of it, I started seeing this success bias that managers brought to the company everywhere. So I would start hearing it all the time, like, well, at Google, you know, and then insert whatever they did at Google. And then I would also start to notice that new managers, you know, as we're growing really quickly, you're promoting people from within consistently and constantly. They would do whatever their manager did, not whatever, you know, we believe to be true at Twitter or what they necessarily thought they should do. So I created this course called Managing at Twitter that's basically, here's how I want you to manage. Here's how I expect you to manage, and here's why it's important to me, and here's why it's important to the company. And it's really simple. It's got three components to it. I don't have any slides. I just stand in front of 25 or so managers every 4 or 5 weeks, and 3 hours one afternoon and 3 hours the next morning. And I talk through them, setting direction, why it's important to set direction. And setting direction is just about defining the problem for your team, setting metrics against which you're going to hold them accountable to that problem, and then letting them go build and create the solution so that they're much more committed and much more excited about figuring that out than if you tell them, go do this. Right? It's not go do this, it's set direction. And I do the same thing with the company. The second part of it is giving and getting feedback. Managers, especially here in Silicon Valley, are really bad about giving direct feedback. And even actually, even soliciting constructive feedback. But and I think it might not even be particular to Silicon Valley, but I've just noticed it here in the Valley. It's probably endemic to management around the world. But what I mean by giving direct feedback is, let's say you and Mike want a pancake, okay? And you both come to me and said, you know, I think, I'll just use a crazy, silly example. You know, I think I should get the pancake because I did my last two things on time and on budget, and I've worked here a long time, and et cetera, et cetera. And Mike comes to me, and I think I should get a pancake because I've never had a pancake before, and they sound amazing. And if I don't, in fact, if I don't get a pancake, I'm going to go to Google because they've offered me 4 pancakes, and you know, blah, blah, blah. And what I've observed is that even managers who generally are doing a pretty good job will do things like, when they make a decision, have separate meetings with you guys. And they'll say, hey, Nick, I'm really excited about this. I went to bat for you. I got you the pancake. No one thought you should have a pancake more than you. You get the pancake. And I'm really happy for you.
Thank you.
And listen, I really went to bat for you on that, but, you know, congratulations. And then they'll call Mike in and say, Mike, no one wants me to have a pancake more than you. Like, I am your biggest fan. I know Google offered you. Right? And they'll tell you two different stories. And Mike will leave the room thinking he was supposed to get the pancake, but for some reason that jerk Nick Filton got it. And Nick will leave the room thinking he's Dick's favorite employee. And actually, sometimes it's even worse. The manager will allocate 200% of available pancakes, right? He'll give it to both of them, right? And, you know, we laugh about this, but it's true. And so I spend a bunch of time with my managers helping them understand, look, this quadrant of communication, if you think of communication as being super clear on one side of the x-axis and unclear on the other side, and then the y-axis being at the bottom, I perceive the way this person receives this communication will be poor. I think they'll be upset with me when I tell them this. And the top of the y-axis is they'll be happy when I tell them this. It's almost impossible for new managers and, frankly, some experienced managers to keep a conversation in the I'm going to be as clear as possible, irrespective of where I end up on the y-axis.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
The point isn't to, like, be a jerk and make sure they leave the room unhappy.
I got the pancake. Everything's good.
You got the pancake. But the point is also to make sure everyone has a clear understanding of exactly the decision that's been made and why it's been made. And trust gets built when I'm clear with you, despite your, you know, how much you're yelling at me or how much you're depressed.
Yep.
Anyway, the final part of the course is improving your team. I have this belief that, you know, there are a couple ways to think about running your team, and one is, you know, you can run it, as a friend of mine in the industry calls it, the Marxist way, which is to each according to his needs, and I'm going to spend most of my team with my low performers or the people who come and complain to me a lot because they've got issues. And, you know, those guys who are over and those women who are over there in the corner, like, doing an amazing job and never ask me any questions, I'm just going to let them go because they're great. And then there's the way I want you to run your team, which is the Darwinian way, right? And, you know, make sure you're spending your most of your time with your top performers and your top potential people who are going to make the team better in the long run.
Good answer. I have a question here about...
Let me just say make a meta point about that. I think that management is an undervalued competency in I might have a parochial view of this because it's where I work and spend my time, but in Silicon Valley, where we value technology,
I think a lot
and
of things
we value
are
design,
in Silicon Valley.
Yeah, and maybe a lot of things are undervalued, but let me just focus specifically on management for the moment and say that I think that's an undervalued competence.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
I think what happens is that you have these instances where...
You finished the wine. We were supposed to go to the... Anyway. Sorry, go ahead.
Did you lose the ping pong ball?
I go ahead.
I think what happens in the Valley is that, people do a startup and they're immediately entrepreneurs. But you're not immediately an entrepreneur. Like, it's not something this is your fourth company. Like,
yeah.
you finally learn these things. And I think that as a result, people just think, like, okay, I attached that name to myself and that's what I am. So, anyway. There's a question here about why 6-second videos for Vine. Just this accelerate. And I actually have this question too, and I have a different version of it. So when Twitter became 140 characters, it became 140 characters because of text message, because at the time a lot of people were using text message. And so the limitation was created because of the technology.
Yes.
So with Vine, you're creating the limitation because of people's ability to consume content. You're not, there's no limitation that says I have to can only create 6-second videos.
Okay, so I agree with the first part of that hypothesis.
Oh, that 140 characters?
Yes.
Okay.
But I don't necessarily agree with the second part of the hypothesis.
So why 6 seconds? Just an arbitrary number, or?
Well, so I didn't, let me first be clear. So Vine is a company we acquired before it launched. It was three folks in New York at the time who were building this application. We acquired them and then have continued to invest in them. And they've recently launched the application. And the application is, as Nick mentions, these 6-second videos that are very easy to create and edit iOS, on the iPhone. And the beauty, I guess, so those guys picked the 6 seconds. And the beauty of the 6 seconds is it's so tightly constrained that it allows you to tell these super short stories in a way that's different than any other form of video. In much the same way, or similar way rather, that Twitter and 140 characters allows you to tell these stories and have these conversations in a very almost poetically constrained way that's very, very different from any other form of communication,
yep.
Text communication. So when Jack and I saw it, and Jack saw it first and then called me and said, you gotta see these guys before they go back to New York tomorrow, and we did and moved very quickly, the thing that struck both of us was, this is the thing we've been looking for. You know, when Instagram was acquired by Facebook, I happened to be in Tokyo at the time, and one of the things I got asked by the reporters over there right away is, you know, what do you guys feel you have to go, you know, buy a photo sharing app now? And I said at the time that, look, that's not the way we run the company. You know, it's like driving by looking in the side view mirror. You know, you have to have a point on the horizon that you want to drive toward and go there, irrespective of what these other people are doing. And so we're going to do that. And when we saw Vine, we really felt like this is like the next.
So why not just put it into Twitter? Why not just have a little button next to your tweet button that says V or whatever, so that you can create a Vine? Why create an entire social different network?
I think the beauty of letting it go and seeing what happens is that it's possible that with the that freedom of the 6-second video environment in which that's the critical mass of what people are doing, other potentially interesting and beautiful forms of dealing with that medium will emerge. So, for example, within Twitter, the at symbol and at replies and hashtags and retweet and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera emerge. Stuffing Vine into that context that already had critical mass and a language and a structure might constrain the interesting things that might evolve out of Vine. And in fact, we're already seeing these interesting kinds of things that people are doing within Vine that may be because it's of its own self and the people there are doing their own thing and they're not a subset of Twitter.
What's the favorite, your favorite Vine that you've seen?
Well, it happens to be a Twitter employee, Ian Podgem, who's absolutely remarkable at it. And I would say his string of them are probably my favorite Vines. He's got a little Dying for Coffee, favorite one.
Yeah, I've seen that. The little man
yes,
that runs.
Man yes, in the desert, yeah, yes.
you used to...
It's funny. This guy puts this incredible amount of time and effort into these
absolutely.
Vines. And then we're up here going, yeah, the guy in the desert was the thing. It's amazing. It's remarkable when you see these what he's been able to do in this 6-second video.
They are pretty phenomenal. We have more cards here than
they're
we
keep
should.
Coming.
We should do.
The cards are pouring
we
in.
We should just let's do another card here. Go on, pick one. I'm closed. I'm not gonna look. I can tell you which card you picked.
There you go.
It is the one about a Twitter question. Do you think Benedict going to use his Twitter account now that he's stepped down, retired? That's the Pope. That was, and then it has a smiley face.
I don't know the answer to that.
It's a Pope. It's actually a Pope.
That's supposed to be the Pope.
That's a Pope.
I don't know the answer to that question. We'll have to see what happens there with that account and the next person that steps into the role.
Into the role. I did think it was really impressive what they did when they.
Mm-hmm. You know, it was.
It was very 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 cool. So you used to be an improv comedian. Is that right?
Yes, sir.
Do you miss that?
No, I get to do it now. People are, I mean, of course, some of that I miss.
I mean, it's like,
there's
okay,
a real, I'll it, tell you the beauty, the great yeah. thing about improvisation is, there's an amazing thing about being on stage with, zero to N other people and doing something that has just been created in that environment between you and the other people on stage that has never existed before and you didn't think of backstage and wasn't written down, and it gets this amazing laugh and then it builds on itself and is incredibly funny. That's like, there's nothing else like that.
So how you did a show called Something in Science. What was it?
Modern Problems in Science.
And how did it work?
Modern Problems in Science was me and two other improvisers. One of the guys is still in the UK doing a bunch of comedy work over there. And we came out on stage. It was an hour-long show.
Yeah.
We came out on stage with nothing written down at all.
So you know nothing.
Ever.
You literally are... It's,
nothing.
It's,
this size an audience, basically, every once a week in Chicago. And we came out on stage and said, all right, we're going to be tonight three professors, and we're going to prove some absurd scientific hypothesis to be true.
Okay.
You know,
and what? How are the professors picked?
So we would take a suggestion from the audience of the absurd scientific hypothesis, right? The center of the universe is a live chicken. You know, is a chicken named Bernie? Whatever. Chairs are weightless, right?
Things and then like you that. Have to argue.
No, and then we would take suggestions for each of us for an academic discipline, and the one thing we had set up was. The first guy who took his suggestion was the guy who was actually had more of a science background. This guy was a geologist. And he would take the first suggestion for discipline because the first suggestion you would get was generally something that was real, like geology or biology or something like that.
So they're using weightless chickens on chairs.
I would take the second suggestion. And then people would start to realize, oh, we can really like stick it to them. And they would say like Eskimo poetry, And then the third suggestion, by the time Rich, Fulcher, who got the third suggestion. The suggestions were really, you know, medieval Russian literature and everything else. So, and then we would say, okay, that's it. We're going to prove this to be true over the course of the next hour. And we just went for an hour.
And so do you?
And we took that, the Fringe Festival in Edinburgh and Adelaide.
Yeah, you went
and
all around the world. And
Montreal Comedy and Festival and everything
and
else.
Did Chicago theaters. And so, what
you?
You
can still Google it, actually. There are Chicago sometimes.
I've seen some photos of you. And you had a little bit more hair, not much, just a little bit.
Loves the bald jokes.
I have to do a radio reminder. Would you like to do the radio reminder? I'll do it. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Our speaker today is Dick Costolo, CEO of Twitter. You can also find Commonwealth Club programs online at Fora TV.
Feels like the BBC when
does,
we do that.
Should I do
really,
it in a
no,
British accent?
No, you don't need to.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club California radio program.
Yes.
Our speaker today is Dick Costolo,
yes.
CEO
Next
of
World
Twitter.
Next World Snooker Championships. Yes.
What did you learn from improv that you applied to business?
Oh, gosh, lots of stuff.
Give me one thing, because we only have 30 minutes.
Well,
we've
talked about this a little bit. We've talked about this a little bit before. But the first thing is listening. You cannot go out into an improvisation scene with multiple other people on the stage and have any success at all unless you're listening very closely to what's being said. Otherwise, you're going to step on some initiation or moment somebody else on stage has created, and then the audience is just going like, these guys aren't even like paying attention to each other. The guy went over there a moment ago and pulled, you know, a knife out of that drawer, and now Dick's going over there and turning on the TV where the knife drawer is. Now I don't believe any, right? And the audience will literally like go, and off they go.
Yeah.
You might not even notice that they're doing it, but they do. Once you start creating a reality that everyone's paying attention to, or you're listening to each other, the audience is like with you. And so it's one of the things I tell my managers. Like, you can't communicate if you don't listen, right? I see evidence of that all the time. People who will say, here's this decision I've made, and it's a super long email, and then there are 50 responses to, I don't agree with this because blah, 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 blah. And I'll always know that's a manager who didn't gather feedback or listen before they made their decision, because now they can't communicate the context for the decision they've made, since they have no idea what people thought, and they communicated this completely different line of things that they thought were related to that decision.
So on stage with three people, or four people, or however many it is there a quote-unquote CEO? Is there one person that's kind of leading it, or is it literally
No.
four people that are equal?
It's literally in that environment that you have to be, in that improv scene where everything's being created out of scratch.
So,
unless you initiate status on stage, if you know you walk out on stage and I say, Nick, if you're late again for dinner, you know, your mother and I are gonna, okay, well, now there's a relationship established and I've got status over you, etc.
Got it. So and then you can decide.
I'll give you one more improv thing that
okay.
I carried through.
Yeah.
I think that one of the other rules of improv is don't say no, right? And don't say yes, but. It's always yes and.
Yes and.
And so it's accepting. It's really similar to listening.
Mm-hmm.
It's
I'm sorry,
okay.
What were you saying?
I understand. It's. I get that. And this. And
yes,
also this.
And this.
Right. And so that's
so you,
an important thing.
You don't say
thing.
But.
I find myself not saying no a lot. I find myself saying, you know. When Mike says, well, I think I should have gotten a pancake, don't you? I say, listen,
yes.
I understand that you think you should have gotten a pancake.
Nick Milton got it.
And I understand that you think, you know, that Google's going to blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
So I try to help them understand.
Yeah.
I hear what you're saying. I get that context. Here's what we're doing. I've made my decision. Let's talk about what you're going to work on next, right?
So this is really interesting because so you're on stage with three or four people and you're kind of equal. And when you did your first
– two other people. There were three of us.
So there's three
of
you.
You keep on wanting it to be a bigger cast.
Let's pretend it's four.
Right.
It's on your Wikipedia page.
yes. See, this is good. We're improvising.
We're improvising here. Should I be a professor? Or
no.
Should I still be the British guy?
You should be a hardware hacker.
It's on your Wikipedia – well, a hardware hacker. So you, when you did the three companies prior to becoming the CEO of Twitter,
mm-hmm.
you had four very equal partners. And
yes.
I've read the papers and research in the Harvard Business Review where you guys literally had 25% each. How has it?
Well,
has
that was
it been
equity. That
equity?
Was equity allocation. Yeah.
But you also had roles there were roles within the organization
yeah.
where you did X. Has it been difficult to you for you to become the only person in the room making the decision?
Well, I'm not the only person. I mean,
but you're the final person making the decision.
Well, so here's the way I would say that. I mean, I absolutely want to run a company where the best decisions are getting made, not the one where I'm making all the decisions. In fact, one of my favorite anecdotes in this regard was when I first... I have a couple great things to say about this. When I first became CEO, I absolutely thought, okay, I'm the CEO now. I have to start making all the decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And Bill Campbell, who a lot of people in the room will recognize the name, was the CEO of Claris and the CEO of Intuit. He's on the board of Apple. When they spun Claris out, and he went to become CEO of Claris after being at Apple and brought some Apple executives with him, he kind of had the same, okay, I'm the CEO of Claris, I have to make all these decisions. And he tells this great story where Donna Dubinsky, one of the Apple executives that came with him, came up to him after the second week and said, hey, Bill, listen, if you're going to make all the decisions, we'll just go back to Apple and you can bring in some people who can, like, do stuff that you tell them to go do. So I absolutely... as often as possible, we'll say things like, you know, if there's some decision to be made, I'll say things like, okay, well, why don't you and you go, you know, go and think about this and come back and propose something and let me know what you guys think we should do. And then we'll talk about that as often as possible. Frequently, what you want to do is take the two people who don't work together frequently or particularly disagree on an issue and have them go do it so you can force them to sort of work together to come up with a proposal. And then there are lots of techniques to make that effective, right? Like, if you guys can't agree, then come back and I'll pick something I'm liable to say something arbitrary that you both hate. So, you know, there are lots of ways to deal with that.
I just can't. I'm overwhelmed.
Okay. I'll take this one.
It's like Christmas morning. It's upside down.
I did upside down. Sorry. Goes to show I'm not cheating.
This is from Blue Fog SF. It's a Twitter handle. How do you feel about the heavy presence of celebrities and politicians on Twitter? Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
I think it's fine. I think it's great. I think there are countries in which there are, you know, politicians are maybe the first people to come in and join the platform and drive adoption that way. There are countries where musicians are first, actors are first, athletes are first. But the reality is that across the world now, our adoption has grown so much that it may be the case that, you know, some of the big musicians are the ones with the most followers and therefore maybe the most visible. But you can go into almost any vertical now and find the most authoritative, you know, folks on that topic are on the platform. I'll give you a couple examples. You know, in literature, if you're a fan of student of literature, the best authors in the world, many of them, are on the platform talking about literature and character development and, you know, this or this. What do you guys think? And, I mean, Salman Rushdie will have these, you know, discussions that these other authors will yep. jump into. The same as, you know, flip all the way over to cooking.
Okay, so...
you're not going to let me finish?
No, I have a follow-up question for you. So, no, I'm not going to let you finish. Okay, so this
That's
is interesting.
That's the kind of deferential interviewee I am. I'm just going to let you cut me off.
Now I feel like a jerk. Just finish.
No, I'm done. No, forget it. Now I don't want to.
No, I don't
want to
talk.
Yeah. Anyway.
Okay, no, so Twitter was, what's interesting about Twitter is I think celebrities and politicians have been very, very helpful for the network, right?
Yeah.
And
sure.
Now what you have is you have all these celebrities that are like, well, I helped build Twitter and because I was on there first and it brought all these people. So now they're going off and they're trying to do their own like witter and bitter and whatever, right? But it's not working because there isn't a critical mass and they can't, mm-hmm. you know, Snoop Dogg's on this and Mila Kunis is on that and she's actually not on anything, but you know what I'm saying, right? Do you think that there has been, as far as celebrities and politicians, that they still have a pull to be able to drive people to other networks, or is it kind of settled and we're now building on top of the foundations of what they did?
Well, I think we're over, you know, we're well over 200 million global active users now. So networks like that are pretty resilient. Once you're at that kind of a size, those are resilient kinds of things. It's hard to, you know, that's a pretty strong core. So, I mean, I guess that's the way I think about those things. Irrespective of whether it's a somebody famous or non-famous or a particular kind of thing or we created this, different kind of innovation. It has to be something that so drastically changes the way people are thinking about something or measuring it that, people will jump over to the next thing. I mean, one of the ways that's happened in the past is, at the end of the 90s, everyone talked about, when the portals were the big thing, everyone talked about stickiness, right? And remember, at the end of the 90s, it was, the Yahoo homepage is so sticky and Excite is really sticky because they have these other properties. And along came Google, who decided we're going to measure how quickly we can get people off the site.
Yeah.
Right? And in fact, there was even a thing on the page there that told you how long the query took, and they optimized for getting the best results in the first page to get you off quickly, and it was completely game-changing.
All right, good. Here you go. Pick one. This is fun.
You're trying to force a card on me.
Oh, you got the one with a lot of words.
Using your David Blaine tricks on me.
This is two questions, and I can't read the first one. So when will Twitter start charging for tweets?
Never. Never. Answer, never.
Never.
Yeah.
Never.
Never.
Ever. Okay. Will there ever be like anything where you'll be like, we will give you Nick Bilton's tweets first if you pay us $5
no.
a month? Nothing.
No.
It's just all advertising.
No,
based.
That just reintroduces friction into the right user experience, and that's not anything we have any interest in.
Okay. Never. That was a good answer.
All right. Like, I'll get in trouble for saying never, and then, but that's not something we have any interest in thinking about. It's not the way I think about the user experience. Like, the way I think about the user experience is, what is the most frictionless way to get the right information most quickly in front of the most people? And you can't drive cost into that equation or it ruins it.
Janine something-something-er at Twitter. Can niche blogs benefit from Twitter?
I think my opinion of this is anything can benefit from Twitter. You've got this real-time global distribution platform for any particular topic of interest that has the critical mass of people interested in that thing on the platform. And they can engage with you in a multi-directional, unfiltered way that is impossible in any other form of public communication. It's the reason that when these events like the Super Bowl and the World Cup or unplanned events like the earthquake and ensuing tsunami in Fukushima, Japan happen, the conversation is immediately happening on Twitter because it's the only place that's unfiltered, multi-directional, and real-time and public.
To Twitter or to tweet?
So I have an answer to that question.
I have one too.
So I'm going to take the more abstract version of that question.
Okay.
So to Twitter is, you can be on Twitter and use Twitter and never tweet. Over 40% of our core active on Twitter all the time users now never ever tweet. That's totally fine. It didn't used to be the case. When the service was first started, you signed up and you saw this white box that's, what are you doing? And you kind of felt like, I better type something in. Of course,
now
part of the reason
box.
You signed up was, I'm not doing anything. That's why I had time to sign up for this thing. And so, it was intimidating. And now that we've changed that, you've got people who are like, there are people on it all the time who never tweet.
Yeah.
And that's totally fine. And I think that the funny thing is, a few years ago where, people thought like, well, I don't know what I would tweet, but it's like saying, well, I can't watch TV. Like, I'm not going to produce a TV program.
Yeah.
I don't know what I would put on there. Like, I'm glad we got through that, and we're well on our way now to, I'm sure by next year, the majority of the users, being as big as we are, won't actually be publishers. They'll be consumers.
Let's do one more of these questions, and then we have 15 minutes left, and I have some of my questions. And this one is, how is Twitter best used for free inquiry? I believe that must mean, how do you search it best?
I don't know.
Let's just skip that question.
Let's skip that one.
I dropped my iPad.
Let's pick this one.
Thanks, Mike.
Whoever asked that didn't get their answer can ask me afterwards.
This is from the Pajama Boo. Okay. Are you surprised by how much of an impact Twitter's had on the world?
I think we're constantly surprised and delighted by the variety and magnitude of the service's impact on the world, both in profound and sometimes like surreal ways.
What was your most surreal moment?
Oh, there are so many. The surreal ones are like, this, I can't believe this is happening right now, you know? And one of the best ones in recent memory was William Shatner and the actual commander of the space station having this conversation about, you know, space travel and space exploration.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's as Captain Kirk and the commander Hatfield of the space station. That was amazing.
Yeah.
You know, they're having this back and forth. And then just the other day, Jose Canseco, the former A's slugger, and the commander of the space station are having this back and forth conversation about, apparently Jose Canseco is a big volcano aficionado, enthusiast. And volcanology, I guess, is what one is, what the field of study is called. And Canseco tweets to, you know, or him like, hey, can you get a picture of this one over the Antarctic? I'm really interested in it. And they started this back and forth about volcanoes, you know, and the commander said, no, we're not, you know, I'm never going to be in a position to take one over the Antarctic, but I can get one of this one. And you're like, this was only on Twitter. You've got this, you know, former, like, home run champ and the commander of the space station going back and forth about what picture of a volcano can you get. But those things happen constantly. Like, you know, I mean, you've probably heard me say this one two or three times before, but one of my favorite conversations is the comedian Sarah Silverman saying, you know, when your family really bums you out, just pretend you're in a Woody Allen movie. And Mia Farrow responded, tried that, didn't work. So immediately started following Mia Farrow. Yeah.
That's good. That's good. My favorite is actually, it has a curse word in it, of course. It was Donald Trump had tweeted that congratulations to that Gawker site, Jalopnik, is it, the sports one, for breaking the big sports story this year, and they wrote back at Donald Trump, go fuck yourself, which was just, it was, you know, it got retweeted more times than anything they've ever done, so it was very funny. Anyway, we're on the radio right now.
Yes. You've ruined everything. You've just ruined everything.
I won't be invited back. That's why I can't have nice things.
We're going to go right to snooker.
Yeah.
The World Snooker Championships. Yeah.
So you're 51, is that right?
50?
No. How old are you? Your Wikipedia page.
It's amazing. What else does it say? He owns four dogs and lives in a kennel. No, I'm 49.
49. All right, yes. Close. Well, they had it close.
They had it close.
I guarantee it's changed by the time we're done
with
this.
Great tagline. Wikipedia, they had it close. So. No, I love Wikipedia. I never said that. I know it's public. Those guys, yeah, I use Wikipedia all the time. I'm its biggest fan
they
and about to be one of its donors, I guess.
So so many, many years ago, 30 years ago or so, you went to Michigan Tech, is that right? Did I get that part right?
No, my God. This is unbelievable. I went to the University of Michigan.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay, all right, so you went to college.
Yes.
Can we agree on that?
Yeah, yes, we can agree that I went to college, yes.
Okay. Did you when you were doing computer programming on
yes.
punch cards and whatnot back then?
I actually my yeah, freshman I, year we were doing
this,
we were doing
this I know is
on
right
punch cards.
Yeah.
You do know it's right. We had to code on punch cards my freshman year.
All right. So when you look at these and this and tweets and this and that and the other and the
oh I see what you're
now,
trying to get to here.
Like did you
like,
have
am I like wow the
you're
kids
like,
these days. No, I think it was at this interesting tipping point, actually. So my freshman year, while it was on punch cards, it wasn't like, you know, that was the only thing available to society at the time. It was what they forced the freshmen to do. There were monitors on Michigan Terminal System that once you weren't a freshman, you could go use and et cetera, et cetera. But so what I mean by an interesting transition point was it was just at the beginning, I graduated in 85, of the transition to the PC era. In fact, my end of my junior year, we had a PC in our apartment that the four of us shared, and you know, had WordStar on it, and you know, F4 was tab and all that stuff. But it was this amazing transition from, you know, batch and a terminal-based operating system to this world of PCs. And it was fascinating just in that moment, back in the mid-80s, to see the transition that was happening to personal computing and the implications of that, and, you know, Microsoft getting ready to be a public company. So it was just at the beginning of this, about to go over another one of the cliffs. And so that was a super exciting time. And so to go from, you know, truly in the span of 2 years from writing code on punch cards to being at a PC just 2 years later was, I mean, just in many ways, just as incredible as some of the transitions that have happened in the last couple of years.
You're married with two kids. I got this
yes,
one right.
You did.
And
congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah. And you're married to a woman with two kids, right?
Yes.
Okay, good. And you have this insane work-life balance.
Yes.
You're working all the time. You're out speaking. You're here now, sitting next to me when you could be home with your kids.
Yes.
Why not be home with you? Like, I know I'm pretty,
so,
but like,
you know, when Ev asked me to come to Twitter in the fall of 2009, I was getting ready to start another company with one of my Feedburner co-founders, Eric Lunt, and Eric's in Chicago, and I was out here. I just moved out here, literally just moved out here. And when Ev asked me, I talked to my family about it, and I thought about it, and we all decided that these kinds of opportunities don't, you know, there's not like, oh, don't worry, you know, next month you'll get asked to go work at the next company that's has the ability to change the world in these profound ways. And that when they come along, you have to take them.
Yeah.
Irrespective of the you know, of what it means in the short term and the sacrifices you have to make. And I think that's true. And that's, you know, I recognize that, and I try to do the things that I need to do to make sure that I'm accommodating the fact that I also know that my kids aren't going to be, you know, in the house and kids forever.
Yeah. When you leave Twitter eventually at some point, do you what do you plan to, like, what do you hope to do? What do you want to be when you grow up?
I honestly
you're just
don't
in it right
any,
now.
I'll tell you what, I'm always a person who is only thinking about, this is the thing I'm doing right now. I've always been like that. When I applied to university, I only applied to University of Michigan.
Yep.
Like when you ask, if someone asked me, what were you going to do if you didn't get into University of Michigan?
Not Michigan Tech.
Yeah, I didn't like think about like that, what I was going to do if I didn't get in. And you know, when I was graduating with a CS degree from Michigan, and I turned down all my offers and decided I'm going to go to Chicago and like try to get into Second City.
Yeah.
I didn't think about, oh, you know, that'll really look stupid 2 years from now if you try to go to get a job.
Yeah.
And like, what'd you do for the last 2 years? Oh, I was like improvising in Chicago and working at the Crate and Barrel on Michigan Avenue at the front desk wrapping wedding gifts, which is what I was doing. I remember one of my Michigan graduates, one of my buddies from Michigan, came into the Crate and Barrel like a year later. He was like, whoa, what happened? You know, I don't know what he thought must have happened, but
so do you
I really love wrapping wedding gifts.
Yeah, I'm sure you're good at it.
That's why I'm here.
I'm sure you're good at it. Do you miss that life?
What, the working at the front desk at Crane Barrel?
No, the improv. I mean,
yeah, but listen, you know, the grass is always greener on the other side.
It's
just as political as,
oh,
you know, these other organizations are. And you don't make any money until you really made it.
Yeah.
You know, you've got the supply and demand thing, right? Like there's 1,000 people trying to get into Second City, and there's only 6 people on the main stage at any one time, and you're doing 7 shows a week, and you've only got Monday off, and it's every Friday and Saturday and Thursday night at, you know, this PM until that PM. So, like, there's, you know, it always looks great. Like, I wish I could do that over there. It's not necessarily the case. One interesting thing that happened along these lines, I was in, when I first went down to Chicago and was working in improv or trying my hand at it, Steve Carell and I were in the same group, and I saw him at this fundraiser for the Lucile Packard Children's Hospital last year, and I showed him this photo of our group, and, you know, we were talking about, oh, that's, you know, that's so-and-so, and that's Marty Duffy, and that's so-and-so, and he patted me on the back. He said, I'm really sorry it didn't work out for you. You know? Anyway, yeah. Couldn't, and talk about, you know, success couldn't happen to a nicer guy. That guy's, like, as great as they come.
So. Yeah. No, it's pretty amazing that you were, you know, you're CEO now of a company and that they were all, you know, your improv buddies. This is a blank one. Let's do one more of these, and then I have something, a little fun thing we're going to do. What's next for Twitter?
Write my actual Wikipedia page. What's next for Twitter? So
that's
what's next for Twitter is really is thinking and building out Twitter, the platform. And Twitter, the platform, is allowing third parties and an ecosystem to build into the platform to leverage the distribution capabilities of that platform. And, you know, you're starting to see hints of it with Twitter cards right now. The notion of Twitter cards is the 140 characters is really a caption, and when I tap on that caption, it expands and I can see some context for that caption. So if I've tweeted a photo and I tap on the caption or the tweet, I expand to see the actual photo. Or if I've tweeted a video, I tap and expand to see the video. We want that to be a much more robust experience. So it could be an application, a poll, any sort of thing that you can imagine around real-time data or interactivity that people might be talking about. We want you to be able to place into that canvas and allow third parties to place into that canvas, and we're in the process of continuing to flesh that out.
Have you looked 10 years from now, what do you see it as? Do you think it's the same kind of thing with more, I mean?
I'm not one of those people who thinks about this is what this has to look like 10 years from now, because I think you end up building like the Disneyland home of tomorrow, like, you know, and it looks exactly like the home of today, but it's all plastic.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't think that's ever the right way to think about it.
No, it makes sense.
Because you don't have the context for some evolution that will ever so slightly change how things work now, but have this profound impact on how things work 7 years after the evolution. And that could be the way that the cell phone is this, you know,
do you see, like, you know, I think we're about to enter an era of wearable computing. Do you see, do you kind of envision a world where you'll be tweeting from your eyeballs or...
Like the Google Glass kind of stuff?
Yeah, like Google Glass. Blink and you're like,
take
you just
a photo of what we're doing right now?
Your tweets.
I think that wearable computing will have a profound impact on all sorts of things. You'll have more social context for the environment you're in.
And Twitter
and
will
so
be
forth.
A big part of that.
I think that Twitter will probably be a big part of that, sure.
Yeah. Okay, so we have 2 minutes left. So I got the 8 questions from inside the actor's studio because you were an actor, so I figured we could have a little fun because I would never be able to do this with anyone else and it would make sense for you. So what is your favorite word? Have you seen the show? They're like quick answers.
I know, and you're going to say you're supposed to be an improviser,
yeah.
Blah, blah, blah. The problem with these things is you come up, here's what I'm going to have the abstraction of the answer
it's
to this question.
It's just one word, by the way.
I know. Like, here's what happens, though. People invent an answer, and then they back into some justification of it. So, like...
Twitter?
Tweet. My favorite word is onomatopoeia.
Is it? That's a good word.
Yeah.
Okay. What is your least favorite word? Facebook.
My least favorite words are words that sound mushy. Mushy is probably my least favorite word because it's the manifestation of that. But things that sound like they're things that are not concrete, I dislike intensely. In fact, I don't like the feeling I get hearing them.
Are you okay? You need a hug?
No, I did. Yeah, I'm not okay. Starting to sweat a little bit, actually. Like, you know what I mean? Does
yeah,
that make
no,
sense
I totally
to you?
Get it.
Like
absolutely.
Things that don't feel, yeah, mushy. Yeah. Don't everyone start saying it,
mushy.
Or I'll freak out.
Mushy. What sound do you love?
Like the sound of a whip cracking, like a crack. not because of the notion of, see, this is what I mean. You have to start, this is why I hate these things. People start saying, like, oh, he's a slave driver. Like, no, I like this, like the crisps, you know, here's the better version of it. The snap of
the
finger.
The snap of a finger.
Thank
yeah.
you.
It's done.
Which,
kill him.
Not quite as elegant as the sound of a whip cracking.
What sound do you hate?
I'm trying to not just answer
silence.
This the same way I answered the words. No, I like silence a great deal. I enjoy silence tremendously. I don't like this. I know exactly the answer to this question. I really, really hate the sound of anything that sounds like whining, like a siren. A siren sounds like whining. I hate those sounds.
Okay.
Wee, mushy.
yeah.
What profession other than yours would you like to attempt?
Oh, well, I mean, I've already attempted it, so.
That's it?
Yeah.
Okay.
And you know what I would, you know what I would love to attempt that I haven't attempted?
Yeah.
I would love to attempt to be a writer. Or a hardware hacker. No, a writer. No, I would love to try to be a writer.
All right, and we have one last question.
I fancy myself a decent writer.
I think
so the problem
I think,
when
I can
you
see that.
Think
your
you're
tweets are good.
Decent at something is you start to feel like you're, you could
you're,
be great
you're,
at it.
You're funny. You're
yeah.
good on Wikipedia.
All right.
Last question. What profession would you not like to do?
Oh, there are so many.
Pick one.
Like
being a writer.
There's so many that are just under. I feel like that are underappreciated. I could never ever be like a policeman or a fireman or something like that. I don't think those are these incredibly noble professions that are these long stretches of training and learning and training and learning and training with these very brief flashes of massive, high-intensity, life-threatening, panic-riddled, you know, emotional context.
Just like being a CEO in Silicon Valley.
That would probably give me a heart attack.
Yeah.
I have no capacity for that kind of stuff.
All right, so I'm just going to wrap up here. I think I have to say something. Oh, I do. Special thanks to Dick Costolo, CEO of Twitter. Thank you very much. We also want to thank the audience. When we clap. Thank the audience here on the radio and television and the internets. Tonight's program has been underwritten by Accenture. I'm Nick Bilton, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned, and I get to bang the gavel.
Hey, bravo.
Done.
That was great.
Thanks.